into the book of Matthew, the 12th chapter. Matthew 12 is where we are at today. We are really kind of doing part two of what we began last week. We're going to do some painting today. I hope you like doing some painting. I've got several different paint brushes and a roller, and it'll make sense to you as I go through my sermon. But here I want to begin by asking you this question. I think we've all could say we've talked to a person like this. I think we've all talked to a customer service rep, right? A customer service rep that just won't bend, right? They just won't do an exception. It's like they don't want to listen to your story. You know, you're wondering, why am I wasting my time? You made me hold for 25 minutes, and now you're not doing anything for me. In fact, the more I talk to you, the more I feel that you could care less. It's as if you're painting me with the same brush you paint everybody. You're assuming that everybody that's calling you is calling to scam you, that everybody calling to just kind of get over you or whatever, and so you just dismiss me. Anybody besides me has had that happen to them? Okay. The rest of you, wow. I'm going to have you call on my behalf from now on, okay? You know, Jesus dealt with people like this. The religious leaders of his day, the Pharisees, were like that. They painted everybody with the same brush. They viewed themselves as the only ones that were doing what God asked them to do, and everybody else was really a low life. Everybody else was the ones that were really disobeying God. And that's painting them with the wrong brush. In fact, we learned last week that they accused Jesus and his disciples really of violating the fourth commandment. The fourth commandment, which says about really remembering the Sabbath and keeping it holy. We're going to talk about what the Sabbath is. As a matter of fact, I'll give you just a little reminder. The Sabbath means cessation or rest or inactivity. It comes from the verb meaning to cease or to abstain. So to keep the Sabbath really is to follow the principle of one day in seven ceasing from your work. One day in seven resting. One day in seven the Israelites would rest and also worship God. So to the Israelites, to the Jew, the Sabbath was practiced from sundown Friday to sundown Saturday, right? We practice it sometimes Saturday, sometimes Sunday. Depends what service you go to. And so we looked at that they were given the accusation that they were violating the Sabbath law. And also we looked at that the rabbis, in their effort to interpret the laws, in their efforts to really answer everybody's question, had created these interpretations that were just totally different than what God wanted. In fact, if you were to look at the fourth commandment, maybe it takes up that much room, right, in the Bible. There's other places where it's expanded a little bit. But these rabbis had taken it way to an extreme as to what they believe one should and should not do on the Sabbath. So today we're going to look at how Jesus responded to this accusation. Last week they made the accusation. We're going to see how he answers it. And a good way to understand it is almost like how you would go about defending yourself in court. So let's get right at it, at the accusation that was made to Jesus. Here it is, Matthew 12, beginning with verse 1. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. So it must have been probably Saturday during the day, right? His disciples were hungry and began to pick some heads of grain to eat them. So if you can envision, they're just taking a shortcut or going along this grain field, and they grab some grain and they begin to do this, right, to separate really the grain from the chaff. And so these Pharisees, it says, when the Pharisees, these were the religious leaders, saw this, they said to him, look, right, hey, your disciples are doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath. They're breaking the law. I mean, that's a pretty serious accusation. Like, what if somebody accused you of breaking the law? You would take that serious, wouldn't you? Now, my question is this. Who said it was unlawful? Did God say it was unlawful? No, God didn't say it was unlawful. These religious leaders said it was unlawful. They had developed these things called oral traditions. And what they'd done is they had expanded on really what God had intended in the first place. It'd be like this, right? We know what this is, right? This is what? The Bible. Right? Authoritative. It's written by God. But could you imagine if you were to, you know, I've been preaching for a few years now. If you were to take all my sermons of everything that I've preached, you would take all my sermons and you'd probably make several binders, right, of all my sermons. And then you kind of put it next to the Bible and you would make those authoritative. that whatever I preach from up here is just as authoritative as this word. Would you ever think of doing something that crazy? Right? No, you wouldn't do that. And yet that's, in essence, what they did. These oral traditions, these oral teachings, they made them just as authoritative as the Bible. In fact, concerning the Sabbath, they had 39 different categories as to what you shouldn't do in the Sabbath. Talk about rules. I mean, we're not talking 39 different rules. We're talking categories. One of the categories was harvesting. And they had a whole list of what harvesting meant, right? To them, harvesting, you know, to us, we know what harvesting is. Man, you mow down the whole field, you put it in a truck, you take it out and you sell it. That is harvesting. But to the Pharisee, just even plucking it, doing this, was harvesting. You're working, and so that breaks really their rule. But only because somebody accuses you of something doesn't mean it's true, is it? Only because they accuse Jesus doesn't mean it's true. Same thing in our system. We have the best legal system in the world. And I'm going to prove it to you. If you were on the way home, were to be arrested, I pray not, right? Because we're very law-abiding people. But say you're on your way home and you get arrested. In our country, it's a wonderful thing because really the clock begins to tick. The government has to get you in front of a judge to do this. Number one, to explain to you what the charges are against you. It's not that way in other countries. In other countries, they can hold you in custody for years and never get you in front of the judge, number one. Number two, never even explain to you what you did. That's crazy. In our system, the clock starts ticking. They need to get you in front of the judge for the judge to tell you what you did. Also, there's this thing called a preliminary hearing or really taking your case before the grand jury in which somebody has to weigh it and say, you know what, this is not bogus. There's actually something here. There's actually some evidence. And if there's enough evidence, then the judge would rule that you can go to trial. And so here Jesus is really going to hold trial. He's going to answer these accusations that these guys made. So let's get into the first thing that he debates or defends himself. Matthew 12, verse 3. I like this. He answered them, hey, haven't you read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? Really what he's saying is, dudes, haven't you read the law? Right? Haven't you? I mean, it was pretty sarcastic response because these guys considered themselves lawyers of the law. These guys were the cream of the crop. They were the best of the best. In fact, these guys, it had to be sarcastic to them. They had the whole Old Testament memorized. I mean, we're talking this part of the Bible, right? This whole thing memorized, okay? Anybody here have it all memorized? How many of you are pretty close? Okay. These guys had the whole Old Testament memorized. That's crazy. I mean, if you think about it, they never went to, you know, skates, you know, skate parks. They never went to movies. Never, you know, so all they did was just study this stuff, and they had it memorized. So when Jesus says, man, haven't you read the Bible? They must have been thinking, what are you talking about? We have it memorized. But one thing that Jesus really understood about these guys were rules guys. It's almost like a good lawyer. A good lawyer knows all the cases, all the case law. A good lawyer knows, you know, that there's a case in Ohio that's going to impact the case in Oregon, right? He knows the latest Supreme Court rule. Now, a good lawyer knows all these things, and that's the way these guys are. These guys were rules guys. But Jesus is saying, you know what? You're rules guys, but you forgot the most important rule, the one rule that really undergirds everything else. And here is the one rule. Love your neighbor, right, as you love yourself. At the very least, that's the one rule you should have been worried about, and that's the one that you missed. In fact, look at Romans 13:10. Romans 13:10 says this. Love does no harm to its neighbor. Pretty good description. If you're doing harm to somebody, then chances are you're not loving them. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law, that if you focus on loving, chances are everything else in your life is going to be okay. Chances are you're going to be following all the rules that are in here in the Bible because they're all based on love. You know, the Sabbath that Jesus and his disciples were being accused of violating really was for the benefit of man. God created the Sabbath for man, not for God. The Sabbath was a good thing for man. Man, it gave man rest. It gave his beast rest. It even gave the foreigners, the servants, all those people had rest. It was a good thing. And yet these Pharisees had changed it in such a way that really it became a burden. They try to really interpret the laws of God without understanding the heart of God. You know, it reminds me of a professor that I had in college. I don't know if anybody here had bad professors in college. I had this one professor. I don't know if he was an egomaniac or he hated students or what it was. But I still remember the first day of class. We knew the first day of class we were in trouble because this is the way he started off. He says, some of you guys, you think you're good writers. Some of you think you're good at English, you're good at grammar because you got A's in high school. He says, this is what you need to do. He says, forget everything you know. Forget everything you know. He says, now you're going to do it my way. Thinking, why did I go to school for 12 years, right? This guy's telling me to forget everything I know. And then, he just proceeded to just fill us with a bunch of nonsense. This guy was just a rules guy. I mean, if you didn't write your name in the right place, right? If you didn't, detail the assignment, right, in the right way, if you didn't dot your I's, cross your T's, this guy, I mean, he was like, halfway through his class, we're like, we must be idiots because we don't know how to write anymore. See, in many ways, that's the way the Pharisees were. They had forgot the love. They should have been loving God's commandments. Instead, they had perverted them. Here's Jesus' second defense or second argument regarding that. Look at the house, man. That house is being washed away. Now, in Jesus' day, in the Sabbath, if your house was washing away, the Pharisee would say, hey, you can't help, right? Somebody, if you called us, said, the river's about to wash, my house away. Can you guys come help? In that day, we would have to say, hey, it's a Sabbath. Sorry, we'll come help you after the Sabbath. By that time, your house is gone, right? But Jesus said, no, the Sabbath allows for deeds of necessity. Look at verse 3. He answered them, haven't you read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? So now I'm interested. What did David do, right? Because that's what Jesus is looking to make his argument on. Here it goes. Verse 4, he entered the house of God, and he and his companions, they ate the consecrated bread. What's the consecrated bread? It's not Wonder Bread, right? Something special. Which was not lawful for them to do, but only for the priests. He's saying David went and did something that was really not lawful for him to do. So his argument is really a historical argument, using the hero David. I mean, if you're going to use a good example, use David. I mean, David was a hero king. He was a leader. He was a warrior among the Jews. He was like their man. And Jesus says, okay, let's talk about David. And this portion that Jesus talks about, you'll find in 1 Samuel 21. You can write that down. It's a good portion of Scripture to look at. 1 Samuel 21, I'm going to put it in context for you. It's amazing. It'll blow you away for a couple reasons. 1 Samuel 21, what had happened by this time is this. David had been already anointed to be the next king. He had already fought Goliath, defeated Goliath. The people just thought David was just wonderful. There was a problem. There was already a seating king, King Saul. He was still the king, and he knew David was to take over. And he knew that the people loved David more than him. So there was jealousy that created in King Saul. So King Saul has been chasing David down, trying to kill David. What kind? That's crazy, out of jealousy. So David and his men are hiding out in the desert. They're up, in the mountains. They're in the caves. They're just trying to get away from Saul. So what Jesus is talking about here is David and his men, I mean, they've been running around. They ran out of food. They're tired. They're hungry. They're starved. And they go to the city named Nob, N-O-B. That's where the tabernacle was located at the time. So they go to the priest and they say, priest, do you have any food for us? And the priest says, all I have is this consecrated bread. The consecrated bread is known by several names. Consecrated bread, the bread of presence. It's known as show bread. Right? S-H-E-W, show bread. And really the bread of presence, here's an artist's rendition. Okay? The bread of presence. What you have is you have this golden table. That table was located in the tabernacle. And so if you can see the tabernacle, you had the menorah, which really provided the light in the tabernacle. And then across from that on the north side, you had this, the bread of presence on this table. If you notice, there's like six loaves. They're loaves or cakes. And so the priest was instructed that from Sabbath to Sabbath, they were supposed to put these 12 loaves there in two different groupings of six. And these 12 loaves represented the 12 tribes of Israel. That's why there's 12, okay? And next to these loaves were frankincense, okay, to make it smell nice. Every Sabbath, they were changed out with new bread, right? Now, you're like, why bread? See, I'm going to put it in our terms. Now, for those of us that you know, go out to work, we say we bring home the what? The bacon. Or we say we sometimes bring home the bread, right? That's what it's about. What it was, the reason that the Lord had instructed them to put this bread on there from Sabbath to Sabbath was this: for Israel to understand that their provision, their bread, was brought to them by whom? By God, right? By Yahweh. He was the one that would provide, and it's no different from us. We forget. Okay, so every Sabbath, a brand new loaves, 12 loaves are put in there, and also the old ones are taken away. The law said that the old bread that was taken away could only be eaten by the priest, Aaron, and his sons. So really, it was for the priests. It couldn't be given to anybody. So David shows up, and he says, I'm hungry. Priest, do you have anything to eat? He says, all I got is this bread. And the priest knows that he's not really supposed to give it to David. And yet he does. And that's what Jesus is talking about. He said, hey, remember David? He got this. In fact, if you read 1 Samuel 21, here's another thing that blows you away. David was really lying to the priest. Because when he comes to the priest is like trembling. Because he's like, whoa, it's David. David had a reputation. And a lot of the guys, if you read the guys that surrounded David, these guys were ruffians. These guys were warriors. These guys, I mean, the mighty men of David, you should just Google that. And it's amazing the people that he surrounded himself with. So the priest is like, David, what are you doing out here by yourself? I mean, you're the next king. And so David lies to the priest, outright lies to him. And he says, well, the reason I'm out here is because the king has set me on this secret assignment, and I'm not supposed to tell anybody. Bold-faced lie. Okay, we're not going to cover that today. I'll let you wrestle with that yourself, right? How does that make sense? So I'm thinking the priest, right? The priest must have been thinking, I'm not supposed to give this to David, but I'm going to give it to him. David is the next king, right? He's a warrior. He is a man after God's own heart. He's an anointed man. I'm going to give him this bread. Right? Here's the interesting thing, and this is what Jesus is talking about. God did not discipline the priest or David. He didn't discipline them. So Jesus' argument is this. How is it that they violated the law and yet weren't punished? And really, the argument is that there was a greater law, the law of preservation. That it's okay to violate God's law, at least in this occasion, to set aside God's law for this occasion, that you will give people what they needed. As opposed to saying, Dave, you got to starve. Got no food? Well, I kind of do, but you can't have it. I'm going to let you starve. And that's not the way, really, the Sabbath was meant to work, and that's really not the way we're supposed to work. But I want to caution you with this. Don't read in anything that I say that I'm saying that it's okay to violate God's rules. Don't read in anything that says, well, God's going to make an exception with me, so I'm going to violate his rules. That's not the way it works. This truly was an exception. There's a guy I mentioned last night, Carlton Pearson. He was a pastor of a mega church in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I used to watch him on TV. Very dynamic, very well-educated guy. I mean, I was the kind of guy that you look at me, wow, I'd like to be like this guy. But somewhere along the line, he got it in his head that everybody's going to be saved, right? That salvation is for everybody, that everybody literally is saved, that hell does not exist, right? Well, when he began teaching that, his congregation of thousands and thousands began to say, whoa, that's not what the Bible teaches, right? Somebody sent me, actually my son sent me a YouTube video recently where Carlton is really debating other pastors on this whole thing. And like I said, he's extremely well-educated. And so these pastors were trying to be respectful, but they're like, Carlton, I know you know the word, but where are you getting this stuff from? You know, that's not in the word. And that's really Jesus' first argument to the Pharisees. Man, where are you guys getting this stuff from? It's not in the Word. And so we have to be cautious in understanding what I just said. Here's the next argument that Jesus gives regarding the Sabbath. The Sabbath allows for service to God. That's just an artist's rendition of the tabernacle, and you have the priests. I mean, the priests were involved in any time that God said move, you know, either the pillar would move of smoke, they would, you know, and there was a lot of rules as to how they had to fold the temple, the tabernacle, and move it. So the priests would do that. Then they would set it up, and then they would also handle all the sacrifices day in and day out. And the Sabbath was really allowed for service to God, which really Jesus is saying. His argument was that he and his disciples are in the service of God. Look at verse 5. Or haven't you read in the law that the priests on the Sabbath duty in the temple desecrate the Sabbath? In other words, they violate the Sabbath because they work and yet are innocent. He says, you don't understand the Sabbath. Otherwise, how is it that the priest can violate it and still be innocent? Because no Pharisee would ever say, yeah, they were guilty of that. Here's the next argument. I tell you that something greater than the temple is here. Kind of gives him two arguments. He's saying, you guys are really inconsistent in what you do. See, the truth was that the priest worked harder in the Sabbath. You know, I work harder on my Sabbath. Today's my Sabbath, right? As soon as I leave here, I go and I take a nap, baby. I go and rest, right? Do not bug me. Do not call me, you know. And then I usually go and feed myself something good. You know, I'm just like, whoa, right? I'm resting, right? I'm worshiping God for all I'm worth, and yet I'm going to take a Sabbath. I'm going to rest because God calls me to do that, right? But the priests, they work harder also on Sunday, on their Friday to Saturday evening. For this reason, every day, the priests, part of what they did, they would sacrifice a lamb in the daytime, in the morning, and a lamb at night, right? And to do that, I mean, they had to kill it. They had to dress it out. For you hunters, you know that's not an easy thing. They had to get this thing on the altar, right, and sacrifice it, right, have a good barbecue. So they would do that in the morning, and they would do that in the evening. On the Sabbath, they had to do two lambs in the morning, two lambs in the evening. So they worked harder on the Sabbath, and yet, Jesus says, how is it you hold them innocent? If you hold them innocent, you must hold us innocent because we're also in the service of God. Jesus, don't be painting me with this brush, right, that you paint everybody else. That's the problem. Would you do any detail work using this, right? See? And yet, that's the way we sometimes operate. We paint everybody with the same brush, just like the Pharisees were doing. And Jesus said, you can't do that. You can't paint me with that same brush. I'm going to give you a modern example of how you can disobey the rules and really still be innocent. I'm going to give you a modern example of how you can have rules and yet the rules not apply to you. How many know that in New York City we have this thing called the United Nations, right? And the United Nations has, from all over the world, diplomats, spies, right? Yeah. We do it too. So anyway, United Nations diplomats from all over the world come, and diplomats have this thing called diplomatic what? Immunity. Diplomatic immunity. Really, our laws do not apply to them. We have laws, but when they're in our nation, they really are sovereign in the sense that our laws do not apply to them. It creates a big problem for New York City. You know why? Because of the thousands of people, the thousands of diplomats that work in the United Nations, they know that our laws don't apply to them. So in New York City, they double park. They do whatever they want in New York City. On average, New York City says that on average, each diplomat, and we're talking, there's thousands, right? And their staff. On average, they rack up 100 tickets a year. Each one. So you talk thousands of people times 100. That's a lot of money that New York City is missing out. And they're like, wait, that's not fair. But that's really the way it is. And the reason, you're like, where did we come up with this system? Diplomatic immunity is actually a real good thing. It goes back thousands of years. It really goes to Alexander the Great in that era. And the way diplomatic immunity happened was this. Was when there was nations that were either at war or thinking about going to war, one nation would send a delegation to the other nation, either to talk about peace or to iron things out so they wouldn't go to war. And invariably what would happen is the delegation that was sent to the other nation, they would either be mistreated or killed, right? Not a good thing. In fact, there's a story of one where the delegation went and tried to arrange for peace and stuff, and as they were heading out, the way they were disgraced is they were peed on. I'm going to roll up my... We're going to fight, right? If someone does that to me, that's like declaration of war, right? I can't believe you just did that to me. Bam, right? I mean, well, guess what happened? War broke out. You know, war. Duh, war broke out. So they came up with this whole thing of diplomatic immunity that if someone's delegation comes to your land, you got to protect them because we got to give really peace a chance. That's where it came from. So we even have a modern example of laws not applying to people. Let's go to the next argument that Jesus gave. And that's that the Sabbath always allowed for acts of mercy. That there's nothing in the Sabbath or even in God's word that prevents you from doing an act of mercy. That I can't on a Sunday say, I'm off. Right? Even though I say, don't bug me in jest, if you called me and you had an emergency, guess what? I can't say, it's my Sabbath. I can't go. No, because the Sabbath never, ever forbid acts of mercy. Where do we get that from? Look at verse 7. He says, if you had known what these words mean. In other words, if you really knew the Bible, you would have known this. And he's quoting Hosea 6. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. He said, I want mercy, not you keeping all these stinking rules that you've made up. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. You would not have condemned the innocent. Jesus says, we're innocent. My disciples are innocent. And yet you're condemning us. And then he gives them the ace. For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. I'm above the Sabbath. The Sabbath doesn't apply to me. It applies to you. That's what he's saying. I'm the guy that made the Sabbath. It's like this. If you're create a business, right? You're the business owner. And you say, okay, we're going to be open from 8 to 5. Right? What if you decide, you know, we're going to open up from 8 to 5:30 now? Should your employees give you grief? No, you can do whatever you want. It's your business. And Jesus is saying, man, I'm above the Sabbath. I can do whatever I want. So what is mercy? When he says, I desire mercy, there's a picture of us when we built this house through Amor Ministries in Mexico last year. We're going to do it again, I think, the spring holiday. We plan to take a group and build another house down there. But this is mercy. Mercy means kindness. Mercy means that you show pity. Mercy means that you desire to help. Mercy is not that you feel bad. Right? We could have felt bad for the people in Mexico. Oh, I feel bad, dude. No, mercy says, I want to do something about it. In fact, the root of the word mercy means that you put yourself in someone else's skin, that you begin to look at life from their perspective. And you know, when you look at it from their perspective, that's when you really desire to do something. So Jesus said, that's what I want. I'd rather have that kind of a heart that you want to do something. That's closer to my heart than any ritual. See, all this ritual stuff, all this ceremony, all those things were always secondary and temporary. We mentioned last week that they were a shadow. All they did was point to Jesus. All those things meant for people to connect them to God, not to frustrate them with God, which is what the Pharisees had done. People were frustrated. The Lord's like, well, that's not what I meant, right? I'll give you a good example. Worship. Worship. When you have like a, you know, when you talk to 100 people about worship, you get 100 ideas of what worship should be. So that's why as a pastor, I don't really like to ask people what they think. Because one person may say, man, we need to do organ music, right? The other person will say, man, we need an electric guitar, right? Another person, we need something contemporary. The other person says, you know, we need hymns. Somebody says, we need to raise our hands. Somebody says, we need to lay down on the ground. The other person says, well, you just need to sit here, right? The Germans among us. You know, the stoic people. See, and as a pastor, I'm thinking, it's real easy that we get so caught up in all the nuances, all really are the means of worship, the style, the way we can get caught up on all that stuff and really miss the purpose of worship, right? That we miss the one we're to worship. Instead, we're sitting here and we're like, you know, lights, it's hot, it's cold, it's, you know, it's too loud, it's too soft, and we just get, I always say, you can pull me and put me anywhere. You can put me in a Catholic church and I can worship. Presbyterian church, I can worship. Put me in an African church, I can, anywhere you take me, I can worship. Because I don't lose sight of the one I'm to worship. Let's look at James 2. Here's a troubling verse. I hate verses like this in the Bible, but they're there. James 2, there will be no mercy for those who have not shown mercy to others. What does that mean? It means what it says. There'll be no mercy. You won't receive mercy if you don't show mercy. But if you have been merciful, God will be merciful when he judges you. Wow. That's an awesome thing to do. And it's an awesome thing to understand. That God says, you know what? I've been watching you, and you are a merciful individual. I'm going to extend mercy. Next time you screw up, I'll extend mercy. He has extended mercy to us from the very beginning. The greatest, you and I are the greatest recipients of mercy. When we were saved based on mercy. God was merciful to us. He didn't give us what we had coming, right? He didn't condemn us. He gave us an opportunity. And so if he extended mercy to us, we should at the very least be willing to extend mercy to somebody else. I want to end with this. Come on up, worship team. I want to end with this. What brush do you tend to paint people with? Do you just use this brush? Look at that guy, right? Homeless guy. He says, need money, need work, need love. Do you tend to paint people with this brush? You know, that you see the guy and you're like, I know he's scamming. He's just going to take the money. He's going to go booze it up. I just know it. Maybe you use this brush, right? You're like, well, maybe he used to be a scammer, but maybe he's, you know, maybe he's trying to turn his life around a little bit, right? Well, I recommend we use this brush. See, this brush is the brush that looks at people as individuals. The brush that says, what's his story? Why is he the way he is, right? So what brush do you tend to paint with? And how can you develop more mercy? I'm going to give you some ways to develop more mercy. Every one of us here needs more mercy. Here's the first one. Remember God's mercy to you. I touched upon it. Don't ever forget what God did for you. In fact, every day, Lord, I thank you that you have been merciful for me. Right? Let me now be an extension of that mercy. Here's the second thing. Don't waste time blaming others. It does no good for us to blame him. Right? Do you think he knows that his life is not where it should be? When I used to go into the jails and prisons and minister, I never worried about convincing them that they screwed up. Never had to. Never. They know that. And you know, most people know they're in a mess. We don't have to remind them. Here's the other one. Choose compassion over condemnation. Choose forgiveness over offense. Right? Here's the last one. Be open to God using you to get the others out of the pit they're in. Be open that instead of you saying, oh, look at that guy, then instead God might say, you know what? Unbeknownst to you, I have chosen you today to help this guy get out of his misery, to get out of the pit that he's dug. Today I've chosen you to reach down and give him a hand up. That is the example of mercy. Amen? Amen. You know, we're going to...